This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that.
Yeah.
No hassle.
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
College holds a mythic place in American culture, but there are stories you won't hear on the campus tours.
The higher-ups are concerned about one thing, and that is avoiding scandal.
I'm Margot Gray. On the new podcast, Campus Files, we cover everything from rigged admissions to the drama of Greek life and student protests. Listen to and follow Campus Files, an Odyssey original podcast, available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
The United States honorary captain, 1980 gold medal winner, Mike Arizioni.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670, The Score. Oh, what a delight to welcome Mike Arizioni, the captain of the 1980 Olympic hockey team, Miracle on Ice. And he was at the game last night, a featured presence, came out at the beginning of the game, fired up the crowd with the Johnny Gaudreau jersey on. Mike, welcome to the program. We're delighted to have you.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
We appreciate it, and we should mention that Mike joins us on the Score Hotline, brought to you by Aturo, your all-weather tire, aturo.com. Why the Johnny Hockey jersey? Why did you go in that direction, and it was an emotional moment for a lot of people?
Well, you know, clearly Johnny would have been on that team. Maybe might have been even the captain of that team. And when I was with the team in Montreal, Mr. Gaudreau was there, and a great guy. You know, we were just talking a little, and they told me that the team was going to have the jersey in the locker room. And I just thought to myself at the time, I said, she said, why don't I, you know, wear the jersey when I go out in the ice? So that's kind of how it was. And they brought me the jersey before the game, and it was a great honor for me to, you know, be involved in the game in the first place, and then just a great honor for me to have a tribute to Johnny.
So, Mike, tomorrow will be 45 years since the Miracle on Ice. Hard to believe. Happy anniversary, by the way. And that is certainly a moment that changed the hockey in America, the way it's viewed, the way it's played, and your place in the hockey world. Just curious, when you reflect back on all that has meant to the game and the sport, and you experience what you've experienced, what we've all enjoyed over the last 2 weeks or so for the sport that is so easy to love, how does the buzz surrounding this event compare to the buzz you created 45 years ago?
Oh, I think it's far greater now than it was 45 years ago, mainly because today's players are so damn good. I did a podcast recently with Jeremy Roenick, as you people in Chicago know very well, and in 1980, I think Jeremy said that 1% of NHL hockey players were Americans. Then in 1996, when that great team won the Canada Cup or World Cup, I think the percentage was 19 or 20%. And now I think it's 38 or 37% of NHL players are Americans. And they're coming from places they never came from before. They're coming from Chicago. They're coming from St. Louis. They're coming from Texas, California, Florida. You never saw that. You were either from Massachusetts, Michigan, or Minnesota back in the day. So the growth of the sport is one thing, and the skill level of the players is another thing. I mean, they are so much better than they were 15, 20 years ago. This, in my opinion, although they didn't win the tournament, I think this might be the best collection of U.S. talent we've put on the ice. And it's only going to get better. You know, it's only going to get better. I work at Boston University, and I see the players in the college game and how far they've come and how good they are. And not only our men, our women as well. The growth of hockey in this country is just going and going and going. And great to see the players perform the way they do and did.
You know, it's extraordinary. The like we were talking about the beanpot earlier, just the level of hockey in a place like Boston, Boston University. You played there. They have a great team even to this day. They have great rivalries locally and obviously a lot of players in the NHL. When you look back on the moment that you had, that Olympic moment, is it still sort of an unbelievable story? I know you've written a book about it. We've all seen the movie. For God's sake, they played the Herb Brooks speech from the movie before the game started. And like, you can't help but get emotional when you think about that moment in hockey history.
Well, you know, I just think what separates it is the USA aspect of it. You're not playing for Chicago. You're not playing for Detroit or Boston. You're playing for your country. And that's what the Olympic Games are all about. That's what this tournament we just saw recently about. It's representing your country. And I've said this many times, and I'll say it till the day I die. Other than being a firefighter, a police officer, or somebody in our military, putting on a USA jersey is the greatest feeling you can have. And I think the players get it and they understand it. And that's why, you know, these kind of tournaments are so special.
Talking with the great Mike Iruzioni here on The Score. So, Mike, you were there last night, and help us put into context what happens now, because there was electricity. There was all the buzz we talked about. It was a tremendous game. So close. The teams were so evenly matched. And then Connor McDavid ends it in overtime. The star steps forward and rises to the occasion. What's next for Team USA, and how does this help, and what is the biggest takeaway for USA hockey here?
Well, first of all, I think it fuels the players. These guys want another shot, and you know the next team might be a little different. You know, again, not to take anything away from Canada's victory, but it would have been nice to see McAvoy and Hughes and Matthew Tkachuk playing in the game. Mm. I think clearly, those are three stars the U.S. didn't have in the lineup. But that's the game of hockey. You know, it's next man forward. But because we have so many great players, we can afford to some degree lose three of our top players and still, you know, bring up three other players. But I think the next step is let's go to Italy, the next Winter Olympics, and hopefully the next Winter Olympics will have the Soviets and the Czechs and some of the other countries involved, and not just the four countries that played this weekend. But again, it's just the growth of the game, and I think what these players take away from it is, We're not finished. We've got another job to do, and a gold medal is hopefully their next venture and their next thing that we're going to try to accomplish. And we go into tournaments now as one of the favorites. It's just not like the old days where maybe the U.S. has a chance. These guys, I've said we opened the door in 1980. The 96 team went out and knocked the door down, and these guys have knocked it down further. So when we go into a tournament, we're expected to medal. We're expected to be a top team, and I think that showed last night with that game. We can play with anybody.
It's extraordinary to me, just the place you have in hockey history, given everything that has gone on in American hockey. I mean, there is the great one introduced as the kind of ambassador to Canada. Everybody on earth knows Wayne Gretzky and who he is. And there's Mike Iruzioni, and you're in your home state, and everybody loves you, and the crowd goes absolutely incredible, and you're out there with the great one and the team captains. That's got to be, like, one of the more incredible things that has happened in your life, and you've had some great moments.
Yeah, I think, obviously, being in Boston, I grew up in the city, or just outside the city, so I have a great love of the city of Boston and where I live. So it was nice to see the reaction from the crowd the way it was. And I'm standing with Gretz, and I've known Wayne a long time, and we both looked at each other and we both said the same thing almost at the same time. He said, I was more nervous out on the ice last night than I was getting ready to play the Soviets. And Wayne said the same thing. Wayne said the same thing when I was getting ready for the World Cup or Canada Cup. He said, I wasn't nervous. I was excited about playing. He says, I'm nervous out here right now. So it was pretty funny.
Mike, going back, though, reflecting tomorrow on the 45th anniversary of that great moment, could you ever have imagined that 45 years later, when you were that young and you were the center of everything, that you would still be talking about this, still be recognized for that moment 45 years later?
Yeah, it's funny because sometimes I forget the dates, and now when I get phone calls like this, it reminds me that the anniversary is coming up. So, it's something you just never can imagine happening in your life. But again, it's why you play the game as a young kid, to hope and dream about moments like that. And, you know, we didn't know it was going to become as big as it was. We had no idea the world was watching. We had no idea the country was watching. You remembered 45 years ago is a long time, and there was no Facebook or Twitter or social media. There was three TV stations, and we were in a little village in Lake Placid that people were shocked could even hold an Olympic game. So if this thing happened today, it would be just ridiculous how crazy it would be. And actually, the way things are going, we could use a 1980 right now. one of those moments to get this country back on its feet, which I think we're going to be doing, hopefully, as things continue to move. But it was just a time that, we as a team had no idea that it was as big as it was, and take great pride in knowing that we were part of something special. And, 45 years later, it's like when I told the media the other day, somebody asked me how this team, the U.S. team, would do against the 1980 team, and I said, we wouldn't even get a shot on goal. and the guy says, what do you mean a shot on goal? I said, well, I'm 70 years old. I can't play against these guys.
That's so beautiful.
My teammates and I get together now and then, and we just enjoy and embrace the fact that we had an opportunity to do something special.
Yeah, it's funny you mention that, because I think that game was on tape delay. I remember watching that game, and it was not a live sporting event because of the time change and all that. And yet it was is so captivating, and everybody went absolutely crazy about it. And that's a long time ago. And the idea that it still is alive just tells you what you accomplished against. And what was that? You played those guys before the Olympics. They beat you like 9-1 or something. It was like a total,
10-3.
And then
I got a goal in that game, so I was pretty happy.
So, Mike, when you're talking to these American players, as you did in the last couple of weeks, and you're around them a little bit, but what are your impressions of just how they take this seriously, where the sport is? And I know you referenced, I think, I saw an interview with the Tkachuks, is that your grandsons are impressed because you're on a first name basis with the Tkachuks. and just what your impressions are of some of these players.
When I was talking to the team after, I've known Matthew and Brady since they were little kids, obviously because of my friendship with Keith. And my grandson, my 9-year-old grandson, chews his mouthpiece because Matthew Tkachuk chews his mouthpiece. So I put him on the phone with Matthew.
Wow.
When we were in Montreal, and my daughter videotaped it, and if you saw the look on his face when he saw he was talking to Matthew Tkachuk, then he turns around with my to my daughter and says, I'm going to faint. Papa just let me talk to Matthew Tkachuk. I'm going to faint. So, I mean, when you see things like that, I mean, this whole thing, my grandkids were more excited, I think, than I was. You're going to see Austin Matthews. You're going to see, and then when he's talking on the phone with Matthew Tkachuk, Matthew's going to say goodbye to him, and my grandson says, do me a favor, say hi to Brady for me, will you?
Oh.
So, I mean, that's the kid, the kids, they've all seen the movie Miracle. I go to my grandkids' games, and everybody knows who I am because they've seen the movie. So it's great to be a part of that history, but like I said, I can't stress enough that today's players have taken it to another level. And these guys, I get to know a lot of them. There were four guys, that played at Boston University. And they know the history, and they take great pride in what we did in 1980. And I think they take great pride in what they're doing with the game today. But you know, for me, you know, who would have thought, you know, 45 years later, somebody would still be talking about our team. But when it's, you have moments like this, sporting events like this, our team comes to the forefront. And again, it's nice to be remembered. And as I told this team when I spoke to them, I says, you know, what we did is what we did. What you do is what you do. It's not going to change what took place 45 years ago. This is their opportunity to showcase the skills and the talent and the ability that they have, and to show the world again how far USA Hockey's come.
I think, you know, the whole thing is such an incredible story, and you know, we always talk about it, the you know, the big bad wolf, the you know, Red Army team, whatever way you want to refer to it, but that wasn't the gold medal game. I mean, you still had to beat a very good team to get the gold medal. Did you know when you won the one game that the other one, there was no way you were going to blow it after that?
Well, I think, you know, you're in the tournament for a reason. You want to win it all. And, you know, we knew after we beat the Soviets that we had another game to play. And, you know, as I tell people all the time, if we don't beat Finland, you and I aren't having this conversation today. you know, Mike's not being introduced as the honorary captain if we don't win the gold medal. So I always tell people, you know, if we don't beat Finland, you know, what would have happened? Well, geez, Mike, if you only could have beat Finland, if you only could have beat Finland. So it was the bigger game, and we went out and played really well, obviously, and won the whole thing. And now everybody talks about the Soviet game because we did beat Finland.
So, Mike, before I let you go, and we really appreciate your time this morning, this is a lot of fun. What will you do this weekend to mark the 45th anniversary? Are you getting together with some of the ex-teammates? Are you getting a call from Al Michaels to see if you still believe in miracles? What's going on this weekend?
Well, I wish I was in Florida playing golf because it's freezing back here in Boston. And I actually was in Florida and flew home from Florida to partake in the ceremonies. But I don't know what I'm going to do tomorrow. I help out with our high school team, so we may have a game. So I might be on the bench with the kids.
That's great.
But I'll probably have a couple of cocktails somewhere tomorrow night.
That's great stuff. Mike, really appreciate it. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you very much, guys. Have a good one. Take care.
That is Mike Arruzzioni, the captain of the Miracle on Ice, whatever way you want to term it, the U.S.
1980
gold medal team of 1980, which was extraordinary.
And how appropriate. He is not planning anything special tomorrow night, 70 years old, probably coaching high school or youth hockey team in Florida. It's just awesome. And you can hear it in his voice. Loves the attention and the way the game has grown, but not really a guy that has forgotten just how special that moment was for him and for his life and everyone else.
I love the 9-year-old. Hey, tell Brady I said hello too.
I love that he chooses mouthpiece like Matthew Tkachuk. With like, ew.
Great stuff.
Yeah, man, it was great stuff. What a cool guy to talk to.
The Bernstein and Harris Show.
Emery Hunt, the owner of Football Game Plan. Where is this draft strong? Where is it weak? Where is it top heavy? Where is it deep?
It all depends. Dr. Susan.
He is Dr. Susan. I wasn't going to call him out, Emery. I'm glad you did.
Spitting bars over here. We're talking
exactly.
Football.
I don't know about calling bars. Who said Chicago rap is dead? You got it, boy. You right there with Cobbin.
We don't encourage that.
Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
Obviously, we've played against each other for a while. The only off the field encounter I've had with him was at Bueller's wedding a few years ago. But I mean, yeah, he's been a really good player for a long time, and I think that he's someone that we can really learn a lot from, just his experience, and he's just such a pro at what he does. But that'll, I think, really, really impact this group, especially from a position player standpoint and an offensive standpoint. And he's somebody that you definitely want to have on your team.
Dansby Swanson, right on. A really good player for a long time. I think that is an absolutely perfect way to sum up his new teammate, Justin Turner. Here to talk about that and more regarding the Chicago Cubs is somebody who is on the beat every day with them. Megan Montemurro of the Chicago Tribune. You can find her on Twitter at M_Montemurro. And she's with us now on the Circa Resort and Casino Hotline, CircaLasVegas.com, twitch.tv/Chicago670. The Score. Hi again, Megan. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, Megan. We were trying to figure out how to interpret Jed Hoyer's comments regarding spending either at the deadline or now, whether it came to trading or trying to figure out the team he wants on the field. What were your takeaways from that yesterday?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big thing, and, you know, he talked about this too when we talked to him after they didn't sign Alex Bregman, is, you know, clearly the team is not going to be allowed to go over the competitive balance tax threshold. I mean, I think that's pretty clear. You know, they went over it last year, which was something they didn't want to do because of the penalties then that come with having to sign somebody that received a qualifying offer. And so I'm not surprised. I mean, you know, the thought was that if they trade Cody Bellinger, that that salary would be fully reinvested in the payroll this year. But, you know, there's still a decent amount. I think maybe like $25 million-ish after the Justin Turner deal, still below that first threshold. And so, yes, on one hand, it does give them a lot of wiggle room in season to make a move and add to the team. But on the flip side of that, that means they need to be in contention at the trade deadline, which has not happened the last 2 years. Really, it was giving the team more of a shot to stick together more than anything. So they're going to have to play well enough to actually make that useful and take advantage of that. So I think, you know, I think it's definitely notable. Like, this is a team that certainly has a chance to win the division and really honestly should. When you look at some of the moves or lack thereof within the division. And so I think it's certainly interesting. I think just in general, Jed talking about it more, especially I thought the Bregman conversation that he had with us afterwards about how, you know, he had to go to ownership and really make the push for why they needed to spend on a player like that was really interesting.
I'm looking at this, Megan, and I'm trying to figure out how much pressure Jed Hoyer has on himself. I mean, he's been open and talking about this being kind of a potential last run if he doesn't get an extension. And what are you noticing about, in your conversations with him, how he views this year and that pressure that has to certainly be there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been interesting because, you know, he's talked about how he really hasn't changed how he would operate even if he wasn't on an expiring deal. But I mean, I think you look at what they did with trading for Kyle Tucker and what they gave up to get a guy like that. I mean, that is a very aggressive move. And that was, you know, probably the biggest move he made in terms of acquiring talent since he took over as team president. And so I think it's really interesting. I think there is a sense of urgency. Like, you know, this team has had talent to get it done, and they just have not been able to pull it all together. And so, I mean, on one hand, obviously he can only operate within the constrictions of whatever the budget is annually. And so, you know, the expectation, though, is like you have to make the playoffs at some point. I think it's fair to say that they need to, given what they do have on the team right now. You don't go trade for potentially just 1 year of Kyle Tucker to not make the playoffs. So I think there's definitely pressure to win this year.
Last year at this time, Craig Counsell was asked about the Christopher Morel experiment at third, and he said, "Look, you know, we're not really here. This isn't the minor leagues. This is the major leagues. You know, this is a place where we're here to win. Anybody's playing a position for us is here to help us win." And it sounds like something in his tone changed when asked the same questions about Matt Shaw. When he basically said, you know, he's going to get a lot of runway or he's going to get first crack at this, it doesn't sound like it's being presented or framed the same way as the situation with Morel. Am I reading that right?
I mean, I think the difference between the two is, you know, at that point, Christopher Morel had some big league experience. And I think it was more of a situation for Counsell, you know, getting eyes on him and seeing, like, okay, for himself, like, can this guy play third base and be a regular and be reliable at that position? They knew that he could do offensively. It was, we need to figure out where defensively he can help us. I think with Matt Shaw, you know, you can't go in with that same level of expectation, I guess is the right word. You know, he hasn't proven it. You know, he's only played, I think, like about 35 games at even AAA. And so, you know, they're fully expecting that there will likely be some growth spurts that come with that transition from AAA to the majors. I mean, they saw it last year with Pete Crow Armstrong and Miguel Amaya. like you have to have some safety net in the sense of you can't expect this guy is just going to go and ball out, even though obviously he's shown at every level so far he's been a fantastic hitter. So I think it's just a different level of expectations and outlook for what you can expect and what you can project. And so, you know, they really want to see Matt Shaw go out there and prove that, you know, he deserves to be the everyday guy at third base. And there's certainly a great opportunity in front of him.
I also want to ask you about the comments that were made regarding Seiya Suzuki's communication with Craig Counsell. What did you think of why that was brought up? And then how they want to use that in a way that's going to be productive? I found that all pretty interesting.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting too, because obviously, when there's a language barrier, communication is huge. And Craig coming into the organization, and even talking to players in spring last year, so many of them credited Craig for just how honest he was, how much he communicated, and Craig acknowledged he needed to do a better job that sometimes you take for granted or don't realize that you need to put in a little bit more effort when there is that language barrier. And obviously, there inherently is going to be potentially some communication issues when you have a player who maybe isn't in a role that they want to be in. Suzuki has made very clear that, he likes playing in the outfield, that he believes, he's an all-around type of player, that he doesn't want to be pigeonholed as a designated hitter. And on the flip side of that, the Cubs can't trust him really to be that guy because of the issues he's had with fly balls in right field. And so, yeah, I thought it was a really interesting, honest, discussion from both sides to bring it up and be like, this needs to be better this year. And as much as, Suzuki conveyed to us when we talked to him on the first full workout day that, that's still his goal. It's still how he views himself as an outfielder and not a DH. He also acknowledged, I'm going to, play where they tell me to. And the reality is that if everyone is healthy, that there really isn't much playing time for him in right field, unless an injury pops up. And so I think it'll be really interesting to see how he handles that over, the course of the season. I mean, he hit so well as a DH last year that, for the Cubs, you have to roll him out where he helps the team the most.
What's your understanding about the availability for both the opening series in Japan and when they come back, when they finally start the season roughly a week or so later, of both the middle infielders, Nico Hoerner and Dansby Swanson? Is Dansby going to be ready even for those first two games? And is Nico going to miss much time, a little time?
Yeah, I mean, the expectation for Dansby, really, just the buildup was more about intensity, that they just wanted to make sure everything was feeling good at the onset of camp. But he's still been doing everything. He's been making throws. He's able to do cage work. Nico Hoerner's in a very different place. He's still going through the throwing progression. He still needs to get into the flow of hitting. So I think, for him, Japan is much more questionable. Because it's, a week or so sooner than, the second domestic opening day. And it's something he's acknowledged too, where, he's not fully sure if he'll be ready to. And obviously he would love to be part of the Japan trip and experience all that. But something that's been a common theme is, whether it's Craig Counsell or Tommy Hottovy, those are just two games. They count obviously for the standings, or they count as regular season games, but it's a full season and they have to prepare beyond those two games. So there could very well be a roster that they use for those two games that maybe looks a little different when they open again against the Diamondbacks on the road. So they're certainly not going to rush anybody just to have them back for those.
I don't know if this is the kind of thing that sets off Craig Counsell, but some managers don't want to be asked about batting order at this point. And some just say, don't bother me. It really doesn't matter. I know Joe Maddon used to call him lineupistas. And he's right, because the batting order over 162 does not really matter. And yet, at least finding who those first three are, who the three players who need to get more plate appearances than the other players are. Any indication of that? Have you asked?
Yeah, he's not a huge fan of okay. lineup batting order construction questions. It has come up. He pretty much acknowledged that right now he views Ian Happ probably as the leadoff hitter again. And without getting into like specifics, it seemed some combination of Kyle Tucker and Seiya Suzuki in the 2 and 3 spots, depending on, you know, the look they want to go with. But he also didn't rule out too, like, you know, when he managed Milwaukee in those last couple seasons, like Christian Yelich was a leadoff hitter pretty much regularly for the Brewers at one point. And so that maybe Kyle Tucker becomes eventually a guy that they sure try out at the top of the lineup. So it definitely sounds like there will be flexibility. And obviously some of that, too, when you look down the rest of the lineup, like, you know, if Matt Shaw is pretty much the everyday guy at third, you're probably not going to introduce him to major league hitting, you know, in the middle of the lineup. And so there's a lot of different considerations, obviously, that'll be weighed. But, you know, it seems like it'll likely probably be some combination of Hap, Tucker, Suzuki in the top three spots.
Megan, outside of trading for Kyle Tucker, what do you think was the most significant Cubs move, either attrition or addition or subtraction this offseason?
I mean, I think probably the most interesting one and also the hardest to really know what they can fully expect would be Matthew Boyd. I mean, he pitched so well those last 2 months for Cleveland after coming back from Tommy John. And if they can get something to that level, I mean, obviously he was really good, but like you're essentially replacing somebody like Kyle Hendricks, who obviously he had a really high note finish to his Cubs tenure last year, but generally like that number five spot in the rotation was a challenge to navigate at times for the Cubs. So, you know, you bring in somebody like Matthew Boyd, you have maybe some potential intriguing options as well in the rotation, you know, Ben Brown, if ultimately they want to use him as a starter to begin the season, Colin Ray, Javier Assad's obviously a little bit behind because of his oblique injury, but I really think Matthew Boyd is a really intriguing option for them. And I know, you know, a lot might be made of like, oh, well, now they're going to have three lefties in the rotation. But, you know, all of them just present a lot of different looks, whether it's arm slot or just like the mix that they use. So I think Matthew Boyd, if he can stay healthy and build off of what he showed last year coming back from Tommy John, I think he's a really interesting arm for them.
Megan Montemurro, thank you as always.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Who's your favorite rock star?
You're Prince. Morris.
Bruce.
Prince.
Bruce.
Bruce Levine.
Just had a text from Bruce Levine.
Hi, Bruce.
Noted baseball aficionado. Been around town for a long time.
Score Baseball Insider.
Bruce, I really do appreciate the way you communicate up front, transparent, direct. And you've been doing it for years. Happy to come on your show anytime. It doesn't matter if you're in Chicago or New York or L.A. or whatever. Like, I enjoy talking to you. And Matt, it's good to talk to you today.
Thanks, Kate.
Covering the Cubs and White Sox for more than 30 years.
Can I ask you a question about that?
I'm going to go through my speech.
Yes, sir.
Take a look at it.
With the idea that...
And the essence of Bellinger, I think every team wants it on their vanity. Bruce, you step on my lines once more. And I'm telling you, you're the back of the group.
Bruce Levine.
Spiegel guy. What's his first name?
With Spiegel and Holmes.
Is that your station?
I don't know.
On 670 The Score.
I think we'd all be a lot better off if Bruce owned the station. Don't you, Margaretti?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I felt like you would have had our back then.
What's your first move, Bruce, if you did own the station? What's your first move as king and ruler?
Make my bosses give them both big raises.
Well done, sir. That was
because they treat me so well and they give me so much autonomy in my job.
There you go.
This has been a paid political announcement.
You trying to get upgraded out there in Arizona? Trying to get to the penthouse?
I'm just a happy reporter in spring training covering the White Sox and Cubs. And the Spiegel guy, that was fun yesterday.
Council leans into any awkwardness that he possibly gets near. He's comfortable leaning into it, isn't he? So
he really is. There's no real malice in him, though. I mean, in some ways, he's not tuned in to what we're tuned into. He shows up to do his radio appearance and shows up with the media to talk to us on a daily basis. But I don't think it enters his mind as to that we are a key element to his day. He just knows it's a part of it.
It's been cool to hear players talk about Justin Turner. Nico Horner on this show yesterday talking about the professionalism of the at-bats and stuff like that. What does Craig think, and what do you think he makes of their offensive talent at this point, Bruce?
Well, I think he feels solidified and fortified by having a veteran who's won before around, and that he will try to get the very best version of what's left in Justin Turner out of him, kind of kicking the tires here in spring training, seeing what is still there, seeing the bat speed, seeing the skills in the field, and then calculating whether he can play him at first a little bit, whether he DHs. I don't think third base is in the mix. Really, he's only played maybe 10, 15 games there since 2022. But, a seasoned guy with someone that can be a leader in that clubhouse, even though he's not an everyday player. I think, again, I tip my hat to Hoyer and Hawkins for appearing to have a stronger bench and a stronger bullpen as we head toward games beginning here in the Valley.
Brewster, how much influence... Have you been able to figure out how much influence Craig Counsell has had with Jed Hoyer? Because when he first came in, it kind of felt like Counsell was different than other managers, as in more on the same page, so to speak, as the GMs and might have influence. Has he had influence, Counsell?
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about it. And when you go out and you hire a manager who you pay $8 million a year to, who has, the perception of being this wonderful baseball guy with a background of the front office with the Brewers before he became a manager, you have one of the brighter people in baseball. Why wouldn't you lean on him? You look over in Cincinnati and what they did in replacing their manager, bringing in Terry Francona. Why wouldn't you lean on the guys that really know the players, that have tremendous respect among the league, and also can help you in checking in with other players and other people in the game, whether a guy fits in or not? We know about people's skills. We can see the numbers. We can see the advanced metrics. We don't always know whether they're good teammates or not, whether they fit in or not to this particular group. And somebody like Counsell, he can reach out to two or three players, two or three coaches on other teams and find out exactly what the story is on this guy as a teammate, as a player, expectations. Those things are invaluable. And I think Craig Counsell is connected as anybody in the game.
So Shota Imanaga gets the opener in Tokyo. Justin Steele likely for the second game, it seems. Any politics to navigate there for Steele, who's been here longer and been so good? Or is he cool, you think, with Shota getting the nod in Japan?
Well, we talked to both today, and Steele was so good about it. He said, look, I opened the season last year. Shota was the best pitcher on our team, one of the best pitchers in the league last year. Why wouldn't he be the opening day starter? So he was very gracious and very genuine about the fact that he's excited his teammate can go and start the season in his home country as an opener. There'll be two more opening days for the Cubs. One in Arizona when they start the regular season in the States, and another when they come back to Wrigley Field to start the home season after going to Arizona and Oakland. So there's ample time for Justin Steele, if it falls into place, being an opener at Wrigley Field at some point down the line if the numbers match up. But again, everybody feels good about Imanaga. Everybody would be questioning why wouldn't he be pitching.
You're right about that.
Yeah. Here's the way the pitching is going to go. So Imanaga is going to start game one. They're going to have exhibitions before that. The relief pitchers are going to throw in an exhibition game before the opener, and then they're going to be available for the opener. And then in the second game, the plan is that Counsell is going to use starting pitchers to a certain extent to back up Steele if he indeed is the second game starter. So he'll get all of his pitchers some experience, nobody getting overused. I asked Tommy Hotovy today, what will the pitch count be for Imanaga? He says, at that time in spring training, 60 to 65 pitches. That's where it's going to be at, unless he is struggling, unless he is laboring. That's the goal. could be 3-4 innings. If he's really efficient, 5 innings. But that's what they're looking at right now.
Lots to follow there with the pitching. But let's go to the White Sox. Joey Gallo and his old friend, Will Venable, an old teammate, actually, briefly, Will Venable, I do believe. Joey Gallo have a good shot to make this White Sox team. That'll be an interesting power bat to watch.
I think so. You know, you guys help me with this. The White Sox are going to have some veteran presence. They signed Michael A. Taylor, who's a very good center fielder and has been around for a little bit while. You know, they still have, you know, as you said, Gallo is a part of the mix. Sorry for my motorcycle making that noise.
Yeah, no worries.
And they have some other veterans that are going to be in the lineup. So with that in mind, you know, they want young guys to win those positions, right? But they still have to have veteran backups to be there, not only to back up the positions, but also to be, you know, leaders and to be there, you know, when things get tough. The good news is that they're not going to have as many guys like they did last year clogging up a lineup that nobody could really identify as a major league lineup of the future. Mm-hmm. Their hope is that Montgomery wins that shortstop job here in spring training, shows he can handle the job defensively. You know, a few of the others, position players, Benintendi most likely in left, you know, hopefully Roberts stays healthy in center. So there will be some semblance of veterans around, and Gallo falls into that as well.
You know, Colson Montgomery is one of those guys who you're going to want to see if you're a White Sox fan and you want to embrace the future. Who else? Who are one or two other young guys with a legit shot to break camp with this team that fans are going to be able to wrap their arms around?
Well, I don't think Teal is going to be, but they feel the catcher is going to be one of the best catchers in the game. They feel that's the gem of what they got from Boston. So keep your eye on him as he goes through the minor league season. I think you're going to see, you know, some pitchers, you know, their top two left-handed pitchers. Those guys are, you're going to watch them. There's a chance, you know, one or both of them is on the big league team by August or September, maybe earlier, depending on how they mature in the minor leagues, you know, how they go. But again, projecting, you know, the everyday players, it's going to be really hard because many of them have not had a major league season. Some of them not complete AAA seasons yet. So it's going to be a marathon just to watch all the transactions. All these people have tremendous amount of options up and back. You're going to see a lot of that with the bullpen and young pitchers as well. So keep your eye on the White Sox. Keep your scorecard out so you know who they are.
Bruce Levine, thanks so much. Get on that hog of yours and go ride that motorcycle to dinner, sir. Enjoy yourself. You deserve it.
All right, guys. Have a great day.
Thank you. It's Bruce Levine joining us right there from Arizona.
The sounds of Bruce Levine.
Yeah. Huh? At first, I thought maybe Alan Nero had stopped by. You know what I mean?
They can be replaced by lesser players, but as a group, they cannot be replaced. Not that talent.
Right.
That was the motor.
Yeah, there's no question about it.
Right.
We should have done the exercise with Bruce. What? Name Sox name Sox pitcher.
He could have nailed that. The category that Marshall Harris did.
Oh, I'm just saying, like, in a moment's notice, that. He's driving around, doesn't have any notes in front of him. I mean, I'm sorry, even for a baseball guy like that, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure, but, you know. Cannon.
All right, let's shift gears here on the motorcycle. Some big picture MLB stuff later in the 5 o'clock hour. But first, I want you to know that you too, like the NFL, would enjoy a smoothing adjustment. Let's discuss, because some of it's coming out of your pocket. That's next on The Score.
It's time for Ben's Vision.
Our mission starting this spring is to win and to win now.
Projecting how the Bears roster will take shape under new head coach Ben Johnson.
Ben's vision is going to be principal.
These are the type of players that I need. That's the vision.
If it doesn't fit Ben's vision,
Are you willing to move on from certain guys?
Really enjoy hearing Ben's vision.
Current roster, free agents, and the draft.
Our entire organization's fired up about Ben Johnson and his vision for winning football.
Ben's vision.
This offense will be calibrated with Caleb in mind. This is not simply a dropping of a previous playbook down on the table and starting there. Nope, we're ripping this thing down to the studs, and we're going to build it up with him first and foremost, and then with the pieces around him next.
With Spiegel and Holmes on 670 The Score.
That's right. Ben's vision is the segment and is the conceit. Mark Grody, the head coach, needs to be the philosopher king of the football organization. Something I don't believe the Bears have had since Mike Ditka, frankly.
In terms of a coach with that much power?
Yep.
Well, Dave Wannstedt did have some GM power in his time as well, which eventually he did not have. But yeah, like this probably is that. I mean, we all assume that that's going to be the case, or at least have heavy say in what is going on.
And that is the conceit of the segment. So we thought, in terms of talent evaluation and procurement, let's talk to our friend Mike Valenti at 97.1 The Ticket about how the Lions have done it. Did Brad Holmes, the GM, allow Dan Campbell to drive the bus on certain players? And did Campbell, in turn, then allow Ben Johnson, when it came to the offense, to provide his own vision?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And look, for a long time, the Lions were compartmentalized, and it wasn't a singular vision. And what you've got here is everybody rowing the boat, same direction, and it comes from the top. Brad Holmes does not believe in need. And if you look at how the Lions have drafted, I mean, hey, they need D-line help. Yeah, great. They took Jahmyr Gibbs. Hey, they need, you know, a pass rusher. Well, good for you. We just took an off-ball linebacker. It begins and ends with the evaluation. Now, look, a couple of the picks fell into their lap, right? When Jalen Waddle gets taken by Miami and you end up with Penei Sewell, it's a no-brainer. My dog could have made that draft pick. But what Ben Johnson is going to bring is this. The reason I led with that is, okay, the way Ben operates, everyone's playing a role. But it begins and ends with the run game. And that should be music to the ears, not only of Bears fans, but Caleb Williams. Because far too often watching last year, you just threw the kid to the wolves. And he didn't play with structure at USC. And then you allowed him to not play with structure last year. And I thought he did a very commendable job surviving it. Right? He didn't go out there and throw 27 interceptions. You know what I mean? So what Ben is going to bring is, A, he's a perfectionist. He demands accountability. He may not look like a fiery guy. He's a red ass. And I mean that in the best possible way. He will absolutely get along with Chicago and that attitude and the way it works. Structure is going to be important. Now, I am fascinated. This is the one thing I won't be able to answer for you guys today. I am fascinated because, look, he got Jared Goff to play his way. But how much of that was that Jared Goff is good, but he's limited. He's typecast. He is a certain type of guy. I am going to be fascinated to see what Ben Johnson's vision for Caleb will be. We know it'll come off the run game. We know it's going to be a ton of pre-snap candy, tons of play action. But Caleb unlocks things that, frankly, Ben Johnson couldn't do here. You know, we always have a joke. We call it mobile Goff season. Anytime he would rush for, you know, 4 or 5 yards, you're like, look at the wheels on this cat. But with Caleb, that's a different deal. So you're going to get absolute command position from the head coach. He is not a mild-mannered guy. Lose whatever you think about that. He will cuss guys out. He is going to demand accountability. He is going to spread the football around. He is going to make the quarterback's job easier, but it will begin and end with the run game. So when you talk your roster construction, it is going to be completely, obviously, I don't need to tell you, Speaks, completely remade up front, because that offensive line stinks.
Yes, and as this is great stuff and a great starting point for conversation in terms of the background of it. You know, I will say, to answer your unanswerable, and we'll be following it, Caleb's favorite quarterback of all time is Aaron Rodgers. So just like Aaron Rodgers had his skill set kind of harnessed and helped by Mike McCarthy and then, of course, Matt LaFleur after that, Green Bay's always run the ball. They've always run the ball, and I think Caleb will have an appreciation of that. With that in mind, before I get to some specifics on the O-line, should I expect the Bears to trade away DeAndre Swift like the Lions did?
You know, DeAndre is such a polarizing player when he was here. I mean, I loved him when he was available. And then, you had some of these moments where you're like, wait a minute, you look like you're non-functioning. How are you out here? I think here's the best way to do this. To me, deep running back class. I don't need to go down the list, but it is a deep class of running backs. I think for a year, DeAndre will have some familiarity with what's going on, add a young back to it, mix and match, and get it rolling. And plus, Speak, here's the thing. If you trade DeAndre away, what do you get? You're going to get a sandwich. You know, you've already got a ton of cap space. You're good to go there. I probably keep him around because the way Ben wants to do it is going to be multiple backs. Mm-hmm. And DeAndre, even if it's specific to the passing game, can play a huge role in that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Sandwiches are good, by the way. Don't besmirch sandwiches on my watch. Caleb Johnson. Out of Iowa, you as a Big Ten guy. I mean, that one of the kind of running backs that makes sense. I'm thinking DeAndre could be a veteran version of Gibbs in terms of Sonic. They need a Knuckles.
Yeah, you do. I'll tell you one thing. Both Ohio State backs, Quinshon Judkins, Travion Henderson, there's a load of backs this year. But those two really jump off the screen to me. You know, Johnson's tough with Iowa. Watching Iowa, you're one eye open anyways. You're fighting a coma watching him play. I don't know how much of him is going to be usage and how much that translates into the explosive factor in the NFL. I worry about a guy like that. But you're not going to be short on backs. But I'm telling you, Quinshon Judkins would be the guy I'd use.
All right.
They didn't not a ton of usage in college, right? He got the split carries here. He played the 1 year at Ole Miss. So you're not drafting a guy with 1,000 career carries. He's got a little bit of speed. He's got juice. Jumps off the screen. Power. He's a complete package to me.
All right. Mike Valenti from 97.1, The Ticket, helping us out here. Look, I'm wondering if Cole Kmet is a great fit or if they need another tight end because of how much 12 personnel Ben likes to run. Yep. The Lions very high on running two tight ends. The Bears were very low last year. Will Ben want his Sam Laporta? Is Kmet more like his Brock Wright in this design?
Listen, but you're going to sign 17 tight ends. I hope you're ready. you're going to draft all of them. You're going to sign all of them. He's great at personnel and attacking. And look, Kmet to me can be a Laporta-like tight end. Kmet has a lot of tools, and you just haven't had things in place to fully unlock all of it. But I wouldn't be shocked in the least if you go after a tight end, whether it be free agency or draft. No, you're absolutely making that conversion. I would be flabbergasted if the Bears didn't look completely different offensively. And it's going to begin and end with O-line, tight ends, personnel, running the ball, setting up throws. I mean, you're talking about, God, with Goff, they were throwing almost 37% of pass attempts were play action. You know, that you're making your quarterback's life easy, and that's what Ben Johnson has been great at. But make no mistake, this is something, Speaks, I think you and listeners are really going to enjoy. This, are you a Curb fan at all?
Sure, of course.
Okay. He is Latte Larry. He's going to operate the Spite Store. And the opponent will be Mocha Joe. Like when the Cowboys had this thing where Dan Skipper reported eligible and yes, the refs screwed them, Ben Johnson spent the entire week designing how many ways can I bleep you with offensive linemen. He was throwing passes to linemen. He had Penei Sewell on a reverse. He will spite people. He will blow the doors off people if given a chance. So understand, any slight, the culture of the Lions, any slight, oh no, we're going to kill you. And I do. I think it's something the Bears need. For far too long, they've lost their edge. They just haven't been a serious franchise. I'm hopeful for your sake, and I'm hopeful for Ben's sake, that, you know, he doesn't go the way of Cliff Kingsbury, where it's brilliant OC, terrible head coach, right? We've seen that a million times. This guy's the goods as a play caller and as a guy who commands accountability, especially from his quarterback. It's the recipe when you got a guy like Caleb.
This is why we're hoping that it's different. We just lived through Matt Nagy, who was a play collector and not a play caller, really.
Yeah.
You know, and also only had the Andy Reid offense in his bag. It's all he had. And year after year, week after week, it was, you know, stubborn on stubborn. Ben has coached all the different positions. He seems to have a lot of different schemes incorporated into what he's done over the last 3 years, and he's a slave to the run game. But this personality bit about him being the right kinds of petty for a competitive sport, that is music to Bears fans' petty ears, because we don't like that Detroit has risen up and is better than us, Mike. You know, we don't like this at all.
Shouldn't. Yeah. You shouldn't, and I believe me, I understand it. Here's the other thing. What I'll say is this, right? You bring up the Andy Reid offense and all that stuff. When you really look at it, year after year after year, Reid has lost coaches around him, and you know, and then Eric Bieniemy went on to be an absolute joke. That's because Andy calls the plays.
Yes.
Right? So, like, that whole, like, Chiefs offense thing is not a thing. It resides with old Big Red. With Ben Johnson, here's what I'll tell you. The biggest compliment I can pay, it's like a route tree. But everything he does, he's got three or four things underneath it. Oh, they ran that trick play earlier in the year. Yeah, well, it just set up these three other things. His sequencing is really largely brilliant. Hmm. And week to week, and it very Patriot-like. There could be a week where they want to cut the ball loose 38 times. There'll be another week where you swear Caleb plays for Air Force Academy and throws it 12 times.
Good.
He's flexible. He goes with it. But the run game is where it will begin and end. But make no mistake, he'll use that run game to bait you in, and he'll run seven straight play actions. He's an evil genius with offense. He really is.
I am advocating, Mike, for the 35-year-old Kevin Zeitler, the guard of Detroit, who's now a free agent, to come over and sign a one-year deal, give him two if you must, and let him teach the young offensive lineman that they also draft or sign how to do things Ben's way. Does that make sense?
I like it. Yeah, it does, because it's going to cost you about 10% of what a Trey Smith would cost you. I don't know where the league has gone, Speaks, but when did we arrive at guards making $20 million? You know, the Robert Hunt experience. I'm not into it. With Zeitler, listen, They felt his loss in the Commander game that they lost. He blew out his hammy and didn't play in that game. Just a rock-solid vet. He had a really good year for him. I think you're spot on with it, because you're going to be able to allocate that money to other places. And I'm just not a believer in paying a guard $20 million.
Wow.
So, yes to Zeitler with you.
I'd be okay with both. Maybe I'm crazy.
You're not crazy. We want it.
They need three new interior offensive linemen. And what I'd struggle with is if you want to draft a center, tell us about Frank Ragnow. You know what I mean? Like, I'm trying to figure out what the profile is for positions that are hard to scout from our perspective.
Yeah, the problem with Ragnow is he's if he's not the best center in the league, he sits at that dinner table. He's an absolute warrior. I mean, the guy plays with an inoperable toe. He played with a torn pec. He's just football guy. He's a warrior. You're not going to find, you know, Ragnows don't grow on trees. The other problem is, and you're seeing, look, I'm originally from New York. I'm a Giants fan. You're seeing what drafting a center can happen. The Giants took arguably the best center in the draft in John Michael Schmitz.
Yeah.
He has been a pinata his first 2 years in the league. It takes a couple years. It's very hard to find a Creed Humphrey or a Ragnow where you plug and play. That to me is where you could just invest some money in that spot. Mm-hmm. Because you need someone to help your young QB with the checks, the protections, and what you're doing offensively now is going to be night and day from whatever the hell the Thomas Brown show was last year. That was I watching you guys was something. You guys deserve battle pay. I mean, that was my God.
It was a grim existence. I'm not going to lie. But this is what we get. You know, it got so bad that I think we might end up getting taken care of. What are your concerns about Ben taking over, if any, in terms of the full operation?
And I'll say this because there's no slander. It's just the same two concerns I have anytime you've got first-time head coach and young quarterback. I think, A, it's a different thing when you're sitting in that different chair. So can he make that transition that, you know, a lot of DCs and OCs have failed to make, where you're like, wait, these guys are spectacular. What's the problem? But the other thing is what we kind of started with. Okay, you had Jared Goff, who flourished with structure. If Ben forces him into that kind of game, is that best practice? Or do we see another, you know, Crayola in the box here, where all of a sudden you go, whoa, I didn't realize you had that to your game? I think those are the two things. Because, mm-hmm. look, Caleb, for as good as Caleb is, he learned a lot of bad habits at USC. If you think the Bears' offensive line is terrible, guys, go look at what Lincoln Riley put in front of this kid. Every play, he was playing backyard football. And I think that's damaging. I think that hurts a kid. So those would be the only two concerns.
Yep.
But make no mistake, those are universal. But you know what I like about it? Look, he said up front, I'm going to be choosy about where I go. I want the organization I go to be on the same page. I want that organization to be able to look me in the eye and admit mistakes, right? These are things that are real. So he's going to get command of the kitchen. And yeah, it's going to be on the front office. You've got to get players. I think you're close. I do. I think the O-line, don't be shocked if you get another playmaker. Like the one thing when you start doing your show going into the draft and you're doing positions of need, throw it in the garbage. Because if Ben Johnson's getting his way, the way Brad Holmes did it here, they're taking the best available player and they'll figure it out later.
Well, that's an interesting question because they just got Roma Dunze as a number one pick at wide receiver. DJ Moore's locked and loaded. Keenan Allen probably gone as a veteran free agent. They need a third wideout. I find myself thinking about Cooper Kupp as a slot guy. I don't know if he's a fit for what the offense is or what kind of wide receiver extra wide receiver weapon does Ben Johnson go, yep, that's what I need at this point.
Yeah, probably a slot machine. That's been Amon-Ra St. Brown's, you know, greatness here. The ability to operate in space. You can't jam him. You can't cover him man-to-man. It would have been a younger Keenan Allen, candidly,
mm-hmm,
right? You couldn't
right.
cover the guy, elite route runner, that type of guy. But look, the beauty of where football's gone now is you don't need just one player. It's opened up these middle rounds to where I'm going to use three backs. I don't need to take one in the top 10. You know, I'm going to use 4, 5, 6 receivers. You know, go in the middle rounds. Go grab a guy. It's all profile. Mm-hmm. Speed's going to play a role, but it's all got to be players that have high IQ. And I'll tell you the one thing the Lions have always done, and I'm going to be interested to see if Ben rubs off on the Bears organization as far as one thing the Lions focused on with draft picks was the RAS scores. And I know we're nerding out. We've probably just lost 96% of your audience. I apologize. But when you're looking at who the Lions would take, it always ended up being one of these guys who had a top 10 RAS score at the position for relative athletic score. And that, to me, is the recipe to success because every guy the Lions take, they're versatile. They are an athlete first, and they're weapons. I mean, that's how you end up where you line up against the Lions, and you're like, what the hell am I supposed to do with this?
Yeah,
there's dudes everywhere.
I hope I did a nice job pretending I knew what RAS scores were during that moment.
No, it's okay. I know.
You're dragging me along. Valenti, you're a king. This is I need.
Next week you'll have Bill James on and nerd out on the White Sox, right?
I apologize. Why would we bother? Last thing, I think I don't remember the last time if ever that we were in a state like this where not only are the Lions better than the Bears, but the Red Wings are better than the Blackhawks. The Pistons just swept the Bulls. The Tigers are better than either the Cubs or the White Sox. Like, I don't know, has this ever happened? I got to do the math on it, but it's got to feel pretty good.
No, but we just went 10 years where I'm pretty sure Detroit had the lowest winning percentage of any four-sport town. I mean, we went through 10 years of hell. I also, listen, candidly, don't count the Cubs out. I think the Tigers may take a step back this year. The Pistons are fun, but let's be clear. This is the worst Eastern Conference in history. Half the teams don't even try. I mean, hello, Bulls.
Hi there.
Hello.
Hi.
The hockey thing, look, it's year 6 of the Iser plan. I'm not exactly sending him an edible arrangement because we're contending for a playoff spot. But yes, it's more a statement on the disastrous state of Chicago sports at large. But the Bears are going to be fine.
Yes.
They're going to be okay, and I think the Cubs are going to win that division.
Shane, send Mike Valenti an edible arrangement. He can send it on
thank
to
you,
Iserman if he wants. It's up to you.
Repurpose.
Yes. Thank you, Mike. You're the best.
You got it, Speaks. No problem. Take care, guys.
Appreciate it. That's Mike Valenti from 97.1 The Ticket. Mark Grody, not here earlier when we taped that interview, but here now and listening, which I thought was a really nice touch by you.
I was focusing. I was taking notes like I was in a 300-level class at ISU.
It's good stuff.
Sitting there. So, that was fantastic.
There's some stuff in there.
A lot of stuff. I have at least 5 bullet points here.
We're going to react to that and continue the conversation about Ben Johnson's vision as it relates to the Bears and what we just learned there from Mike Valenti. Paul Papst will join us in studio top of the hour, but keep listening to Spiegs and Grody on Spiegel and Holmes.
Red Biggs. Biggs time.
Biggs.
With Mully and Haw. Biggs time.
The Biggs Report.
With Brad Biggs.
Biggs time.
Biggsy.
His name is Brad Biggs.
Brad Biggs talks football with you.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670, The Score. Brad Biggs, the football man of the Chicago Tribune, a long time contributor to the station and a valued friend, and he joins us on the Score Hotline, brought to you by Aturo, your all-weather tire, aturo.com. Biggs A.
Morning, Brad.
Morning, boys. What's going on?
Oh, we've just come to a conclusion that Homeland over hockey. That would be the takeaway from this morning thus far. But that's not everyone.
Okay.
Hey, the price of paying poker going up, well, in a lot of ways, certainly with the tickets, but we'll get to that in a second. The salary cap increase, not necessarily great news for a team like the Bears that already has enough salary cap. That means everybody armed for free agency.
Well, the caps, everybody knew the cap was going to go up, okay? And you looked at different projections of where the cap would be, and I think it's going to – and they still don't know exactly where it's going to be. The NFL teams were given a range yesterday because the league's got to finalize negotiations with the Players Association on specifically what number it lands on. It's projected now to be maybe – $6 million more than people originally thought it was going to be. That's $6 million more for the Bears, $6 million more for the Packers, the Vikings, the Lions, and every other team. So when it's a league-wide thing like that, I don't think it has any impact on the Bears because everyone is getting that same increase of what it was conservatively estimated to be. Cap space has not been an issue for the Bears for quite a while, with the exception really of 2022, when they kind of reset the books and they carried a bunch of dead money this season. The cap space wasn't an issue at all a year ago. What's an issue is not having enough talented players, and just because a team has a lot of cap space, it's no guarantee that it will be filled with players in March that wind up being difference makers in September and October.
Excellent point, Brad. Good perspective. So tell me this. First of all, people learn that they have to read your mailbag because it's chock full of good information, as it was yesterday on ChicagoTribune.com. In there, you explain what might happen if the Bears have to go to Plan B. I guess that's me calling it Plan B. If Plan A is Trey Smith and he's not available for whatever reason, who are some guards that might come to mind as Plan B?
Yeah, folks seem to think it's fait accompli that the Bears are going to wind up with Trey Smith. And no one at all seems to have any issue at all paying a guard, an interior offensive lineman, north of $22 million a year, or roughly that it'll take. And those are conversations that need to take place, right? You know, there's a reason why some teams would be very hesitant or flat out refuse to go into that neighborhood for pay for an interior offensive lineman. Fortunately, there's a handful of them. I think, you know, naturally your plan B, okay, if you can't get that guy, well, can you get a stud in the draft? Are you comfortable with that? Do you would you draft a guard at number 10? Is Tyler Booker, the Alabama player, good enough to say, yeah, we can take an interior offensive lineman that high in the first round? And if you are advocating for them to sign Trey Smith, if he's available in free agency for a deal that's going to cost $22 million or more annually, then you got to be fine with drafting an interior offensive lineman in the top 10, right? Like, you can't say 10 is too high to draft a guard and still be okay with paying $22 million a year, because I think some people don't like the idea of an interior lineman that high in the draft because of positional value. Well, if you're going to place value on it at $22 million a year for a guy, then you better be willing to draft an elite one that high. Aaron Banks of the 49ers, former Notre Dame offensive lineman, he'd be an option. There's not a ton of guys.
Mekhi Becton?
That are close to them. Yeah, I mean, Becton, he was a disaster with the Jets.
Yeah.
He got fixed by the Eagles. Is he all of a sudden the player the Jets thought they were going to get years ago, or was he potentially made better by the players around him? You know, there's a handful of guys that would be suitable one-year options or short-term options if the team has, say, a high draft pick at one guard position and invests heavily at center. You know, you could plug in a guy at that other spot. Kevin Zeitler's from just up the road in Brookfield, Wisconsin. I think he's actually hoped he could land with the Bears at a couple points during his career. Spent this past season with the Detroit Lions. Mm-hmm. He's an older player, though. Like, you gotta have an honest evaluation about a guy that's 33, 34 years old.
I understand that Kansas City needs to fix their offensive line. That's kind of their off-season priority, and they need a left tackle. They've needed a left tackle for a lot. They've cycled through left tackles for a long time, and you would think that they'd love to solve that position, which is not an easy one to do. I just don't know if I believe that they're going to still let Trey Smith. I don't care what anyone's reporting. I feel like you don't get better if you let guys that can play go. And I think Trey Smith's a good enough player that they can figure out a way to get him back in Kansas City. Am I being too hopeful that he could hit the open market, even to have a shot at overpaying him? Or do you think he could maybe be stifled from that? I think they'll reach an agreement with him. I don't know that they're going to have to tag him.
Well, I think that you want to have a conversation with him. And then what's his mindset? Does he want to stay with the team that drafted and developed him and is going to be a contender for the foreseeable future with the quarterback that's in place there? Or is he interested in getting every last dollar that he possibly can?
Right.
And some guys are wired that way, and there's nothing wrong with it. So what's his motivation in this? The Chiefs have got some other young players that they've got to figure out how they're going to keep them. They're probably going to need to do some math with Patrick Mahomes' contract to create a little bit more salary cap space. When you draft and develop and you've got an elite quarterback and you win a lot of football games, these are problems that you encounter, and they're good problems to have. And, the Chiefs might be, opposed to sinking huge money in another guard. They might feel confident in their ability in this draft to go out and get a really good player that they can then have on a very affordable rookie contract. You know, they paid Joe Thuney in free agency in a big way several years ago. I think the deal at the time averaged like $16 million a year. Might have made him the highest paid guard in the league at the time. He's going to be entering the final year of his deal. Do they extend him to lower his number? I don't see him having huge money in two interior offensive linemen, but I'm sure they're going to look for a way to potentially keep Trey Smith, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, because the Bears and a host of other teams, and there's a lot of teams that are going to have ample salary cap space, guys. Like half the league or so is going to be above $30 million in cap space. So there'll be competition for that guy in the market.
All right, Brad, let's talk about this 10% ticket increase coming after a season in which the Bears lost 10 straight games. In the letter to season ticket holders, Kevin Warren indicated, maybe as a way to assuage the fan base, that they would be aggressive in free agency. But it's the same team president that a year ago, I think almost exactly a year ago this month, talked about how happy he was that Justin Fields was still a Bear and would be a Bear. And that didn't go very far. So I don't know what to believe in these letters to the fan base. What do you make of the ticket increase, and how do you think that they did in terms of justifying it?
Well, they could charge anything they want because there's still demand. And when fans talk about being outraged with a 10-game losing streak and their inability to win a playoff game and an extended rebuild and a reboot of the rebuild, well, they're still buying tickets. They're still showing up at Soldier Field. In the last 20 years, there are very few instances of games I've been at where you look at it like, wow, they are showing their disdain for the product by staying away. I can remember a game against the Redskins. It was late in the 2016 season, I think it was, where it was like a solid third of the seats were empty. But guess what? They were paid for, right?
Yeah, that's you know? Right.
And so people could be turned off, but they have a great understanding of the dynamics involving their tickets and what happens with those tickets on the secondary market. And so I think what they're doing is trying to ensure that they have a bigger piece of the action, that if tickets in this section can be resold at X number of dollars, we're going to charge closer to that. So we're taking a bigger piece of the action, and the fans have continued to support that and buy the tickets. You know, the letter was a bunch of gobbledygook and, you know, corporate. Like, if you're
yeah,
trying to appeal to your common fan who buys season tickets, I don't know that was the way to go. But they've got a captive audience. They've got people that are still shelling out money to come see them, that are consuming the product, that are spending their time on Sundays following the team, and I think they're probably pretty confident that it's not going to be an issue for them. It's bold, though, because in the past, when they came off embarrassing seasons and when they played really poorly, it would be flat, right? Or it would be a really minimal raise to the season tickets, and there would be kind of a different tone, I think, in the letter that they sent out. But they're going bold. They believe that they can get this thing going in the right direction, and if they do, people aren't going to care what they're paying for the tickets, I don't think.
I just wonder, as an experiment, just listening to what you said, how high could they go where people wouldn't pay? I mean that.
Yeah, like, well,
30%, 40%?
Someone's still going to pay. That's unfortunately, they're taking advantage of that.
Yeah, that's a sliding scale based on how the team's performing, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if the team is 10-7 and plays in a wild card game next year, they're going to be like, all right, you know, the Bears are back. And I mean, you know how fans are around here. Like, it's either they're in contention for the Super Bowl, or everyone should be fired. So if they go 10-7, they'll be a shoe-in for the Super Bowl the year after that, and people will pay a 12% increase. I don't know, but that's the NFL. It's king. They print money. That's why the valuation for these organizations is through the roof, because the media rights contracts are massive and only continue to grow.
So, Brad, among the items in your mailbag was a description of every new staff member that would maybe the assistant coaches that were added this week and maybe not announced yet. Please tell the audience and share with me how the Bears have an assistant special teams coach who has a PhD.
Oh, yeah, I don't. I mean, I haven't talked to the guy yet, but Anthony Blevins was a grad assistant. I think it was at Mississippi State, and was a grad assistant coach, and he obviously took his graduate level classes very seriously while there, and was able to get a doctorate. So they've got they've got Dr. Blevins to help out Richard Hightower with special teams, and you would imagine that's a good thing, right?
It's impressive.
Will you call him Dr. Blevins, or will you call him Dr. Football, or maybe Dr. Special Teams?
Yeah, they don't let us talk to the assistant position coaches very regularly. And he's been around previously.
I
believe he was a Bill Walsh a fellowship intern for him previously. Has got some experience with the New York Giants and Arizona Cardinals as well.
Impressive credentials. You don't see that very often on a coaching staff. You don't see a guy with a PhD coming to.
Yeah, I don't know that that's something you want to, like, you're using that card very often with your players, but clearly he's going to be a sharp guy, right?
Definitely.
Well, he's going to have like a jacket with patches, and he'll have a pipe while coaching. The long snapper.
With brandy.
With a snifter of brandy.
Yeah. Every time I hear doctor, I'm like, this guy's going to have like a stethoscope around
his exactly.
neck. Or
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. A white lab coat, great. But no.
All right,
different
Brad,
kind of doctor.
So next week is the NFL Combine. I think the Bears as a staff are leaving Sunday for Indianapolis. Ben Johnson and Ryan Poles will address the media. When will we hear from them? And what does this week mean for the staff that's maybe getting together and going on a road trip for the first time?
Yeah, I think they're talking on Tuesday, but I know they've set the date and maybe even the time. I'm just keeping it one day at a time right now myself, though, Dave, before I get to that next week.
I respect that.
I am looking forward to hearing what they have to say. But, you would hope that by the time they hit the road, they've got a pretty good feel for the players that were on the roster this past season. And that's guys that are still under contract and guys that are coming out of contract, and they'll need to make decisions on here in the near future, because they haven't had a lot of time,
right?
But I think they've probably had enough time to get down to it, and those have got to be good experiences too, when you got two coaches piling in the same vehicle to make the drive down to Indianapolis for the combine. Most teams are flying. I think the Bears generally drive that trip, and so you get some bonding. Guys can get to know each other maybe a little bit, but they need to be up to speed on their own team. And you would think there's a possibility maybe they've had some early free agency conversations.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the coaches, the personnel folks. They're going to be up to speed on that, because that'll open up basically about a week after the combine wraps up.
Great stuff, Bigsy. Really fun catching up.
Thanks, Brad. Enjoy the hockey game.
What hockey game?
Thank you.
There's a game tonight.
Baseball's on, Dave.
Thanks,
come on,
Brad.
Man.
Thanks, yeah. Brad.
Come on.
Enjoy the Cubs.
Hey, Mizzou just absolutely dominated Fort Frank, Alabama last night.
Yeah, that's good.
Just blew him out of the gym.
Yep.
All right, guys. Have a great day.
See you, buddy. That's our guy, Brad Biggs, Mizzou graduate. Proud Mizzou graduate.
Proud Mizzou graduate.
Yeah. Every once in a while, the Bears would draft a guy, and Biggsy would do a dance for you. He'd be very pleased. All right.
In 28 minutes. Impressive.
One of six Pistons in double figures, led by Cunningham with 29. Kobe White had just 7 points tonight on a tough shooting night. Buzelis, 8 straight games with 10-plus points. Dosunmu led the way with 23. Vucevic, 22 and 13 rebounds. Giddey had 16. Jones with 15 off the bench. Jalen Smith at 11. Off for a week. Bulls will get a breather. The mini fridge.
Everybody got a breather. Everybody needed a breather, frankly. Everybody's getting sick. Is everything going around? You know, you can rest up a little bit, get your strength back. And now we're back at it tonight. Adam Amin will be on the call with Stacey King of the Bulls and the Knicks. Adam is on Twitter, at Adam Amin, and he joins us on the Circa Resort and Casino Hotline, CircaLasVegas.com. How's New York?
New York is a delight today. It's sunny and bright, and there's at least a little bit of warmth, and I'm hoping it's the same for you guys back home right now.
It is. It's so sunny outside. Hold the warmth.
Yeah, it's not warm. What's your go-to pizza slice?
You know what it is? It's the dollar slice. I don't have like a go-to here.
Okay.
I am very excited that Prince Street is now available in Chicago. So I do love Prince Street pizza. But here, I go for the dollar slice, man, the $1.50. I'm doing that before we go to Madison Square Garden today. That's a buddy of mine's coming down from Jersey, or I guess it's coming up from Jersey. We're going to go grab a dollar slice, catch up, and then we go call a game.
All right, if you get the chance, there's a $3 slice called Norm's.
That sounds expensive.
But it's worth it. Norm's is spectacular. If you ever want to splurge, that's the joint.
The $3 splurge. Pizza slice. I love that.
Yep, it is. You know, it's bougie, but it's worth it. what are the Bulls as of right now? Do they know yet? And especially with this Patrick Williams latest injury news and the whole thing with Adama Sinogo being hurt now, are they? Do you get the sense that there's going to be a much more full-blown commitment to development?
Well, they're not bougie, unlike the
Pistons. That is facts.
They're the opposite. They are the opposite of bougie, and I do think that the Williams injury probably opens the door for more minutes for some of the younger guys, in particular Modest Buzelis, which is the focus here. I do think they have a better idea of what they are. I understand where the split is, and because I was kind of sitting in that confusion for a while, as you know, at least initially after the trade deadline, like I think a lot of people were, right? I think a lot of people kind of heard what they felt were mixed messages. I thought it was kind of a mixed message to say, well, we're going to lose, but we're also going to try to win. Basically saying, like, we're going to get the young players going, which in NBA parlance essentially means we're going to lose games. But when you say we're going to try for the play-in tournament, then that means you're going to try to win games, essentially. So that sounds, I think, on its surface level as a mixed message, and I believe that is. I do think that when you dig a little deeper, I know Casey Johnson has done a lot of work on this side. I know that a lot of the beat writers have talked to the front office on background and have gotten a better sense for this. And you see that kind of slip through in some of the articles. I understand writers' jobs. They don't want to give away too much, but they do want to, you know, let you know that they're in the trenches. I do feel that there is a little bit more clarity, and it's a disappointing clarity, right? Because mm-hmm. Bulls fans are tired. They're exhausted by some of this, you know, mid-level running that they've seen the last 2+ seasons now, going into basically year 3 of that, and being right around the 10 spot, 9 spot, fighting for the play-in spot, whatever. I don't think this team is fighting for a play-in spot. I think they are going to make a devoted run with Modest Buzelis. I think they want to see what Terry and Phillips have to offer as role players. I think they want to see if Josh Giddey is worthy of re-signing. I think they want to see what they have with some of the younger players. I don't know if you're going to do what like the Thunder did a few years ago and bench Al Horford for 25 games. I don't think that's going to be the case where you look at Vucevic and say, hey, you're done for the rest of the year and we'll trade you in the offseason. I don't think you raise value that way. I don't think that's good for anybody in that scenario. I understand the frustration essentially being, hey, we've got to wait another 3 months before anything happens or 4 months before anything happens. You basically have to wait until July 1st or the draft around there, basically late June, to see any type of movement on this roster. And I think fans are so tired at times of what they've seen the last couple of years, and they want to change. They don't like the status quo, and that's understandable. They want to see a change. That change, I think, is on its way. I just don't think it's, you know, I think they were going to hope that it was going to happen around the trade deadline. It didn't. So I think that portion of where this team is at, where the organization at, is pushed down the road a few months. But I do think that this is going to be a more developmental run while still trying to instill, like, culture. And I know that's a buzzword. I know people are tired of a lot of these things. I get where all the frustration is coming from. I'm telling you, this is what I think is going to take place over the next 2 months, basically.
Adam, I think a lot of us, we were just so waiting for that trade deadline to pass to see what you just described when you talk about Julian Phillips and Dalen Terry and some of these other guys. Like, we need to know whether or not they can play and if they are going to be guys who would even be here when the Bulls are relevant again from a win-loss standpoint. And it feels like next year is going to be very much a rebuilding, don't expect too much from jump. And maybe I'm wrong in the way I'm looking at it, but the way you kind of just set things up to say it's delayed to the offseason, I can't really foresee them going out and get some difference makers who are going to make the Bulls a playoff team in what is currently the Eastern Conference right now.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I'm also like, I hear you say that, and I know that's what I feel too, Marshall. I think that's exactly how I feel too, what I think is going to take place. And it sucks. It sucks to hear, doesn't it?
Like, yeah.
It's not fun to be in this position. And this is what, you know, is tough about watching an organization on a day-to-day basis. You guys also have the luxury, not you and Dan necessarily, but I think fans have the luxury of being able to turn this off. And they can say, I'll see you in a year and a half. I don't. You guys don't necessarily have that luxury either. I have to track the progress, no matter how painful it might be at times. I do think this is going to be an important year coming up in the 25-26 season, the summer coming up, and then leading into the following season, the 25-26 campaign. It is going to be a lot of growing pains. It is going to be a lot of mistakes. It is going to be a lot of figuring out what and who are worthy of keeping around. And this is what a rebuild does kind of look like. Now, I know nobody wants to use that word. Fine. You guys play the semantics. Not you again. Just the royal you. You guys play the semantics. I feel like I'm attacking. As soon as Marshall came on, I'm just attacking.
No. Let your thoughts flow freely. Do not worry about offending anyone who's listening. Definitely not me or Dan. We don't care. Know. Yeah, just go.
Yeah, I think this is, you know, they don't want to say rebuild. That's fine. That's okay. It has all the symptoms of a rebuild. It may not be a rebuild. It certainly feels and smells and sounds like one, and that's okay because that's what it takes now at this point. I think this is the route that they're going to have to go. I also feel like there are some comments that I needed clarification on. I talked to some people around the organization over the last week, just making some calls and getting some texts and just asking, like, hey, what does this mean to you? I didn't know what, you know, Karnišovas and exactly what he was pointing to when he said, you know, I think we're looking for 9 to 10 great players versus 2 to 3 superstars. And it took me a while to kind of figure out exactly what that meant. It's like, well, look at the last 20 years of the NBA, and it takes superstars, doesn't it? And I understand that that's still probably the case. You're still going to need somebody, maybe not next year, but the following year, you know, if you're looking at 26, 27 being the year where you want to be back into the mix fully competitive, you're going to need some semblance of a star. You're going to need a superstar. You're going to need a high-level, high-quality, highly paid role player, something like that. You're going to need those things. But I am starting to understand based off of where the CBA is going to be, what the second apron has done to teams that are trying to make moves, what the landscape is with superstar players, and I think Jimmy Butler is probably the most recent and most glaring example of it, that when you have somebody that good or considered to be that good that has kind of a stronghold over your organization, how much that hamstrings your ability to get things done. I see where that those comments are starting to come in from and why those comments are being made. Now, will it work? I don't know. That's the thing I wish I knew, but I understand a little bit better, having talked to a few people around the organization, I understand a little bit better what I think Karnišovas was trying to say, or at least maybe what the perception he was hoping to give across was to be. So it's a lot of flux, but I'm at least getting a plan, a semblance of a plan, an idea of a plan, and a timeline that this is going to take, not just this offseason, but the following season as well. It's going to be a 12 to 15 month kind of project to get this team to a point where not just they're fighting for the seventh seed, where maybe that in a bad Eastern Conference like you guys talked about, they can compete to be like a top five team in a conference that's very much in flux right now too.
You know what would have helped me understand a little bit better? Because I'm with you. I just sort of left unfulfilled and a little concerned. But if he had said, the way we're going to approach this is we are going to construct a deep team of 9 or 10 good, young, versatile, two-way players and maintain the flexibility and the ability at any time, should we think there is a chance to land a star, we will have built up our assets, we will have deals that can be moved, that we are going to do this in a way that while we are clearly getting good, like building the floor up, we're never going to give away the chance to make that one galvanizing move.
I think that is what this organization wants to do. I don't think they did a great job of explaining it when their feet were kind of held to the fire. I don't think it was the best explanation of it, but I do think that is kind of the sense around the front office. And again, I also know I've said this publicly. I've said this in radio interviews outside of Chicago, where this is clearly a front office that plays things close to the vest. And I can appreciate that because that's how some of the game has to be played. I also come from the media side of it where I just want clarity. But to give clarity means you're giving away some of the game pieces. Okay, totally fine. I don't think they did a great job of explaining that the first time around. I get a better sense of that now, that is the plan, that you need to build the floor, raise the floor, build up your assets, build up your developmental core so that the floor of your success gets higher, and essentially appealing enough to go get a superstar.
Right.
And at some point in the next 15 to 18 months, or I guess if you really want to extend it to a trade deadline 2 years from now, 24 months, you are looking to build up your organizational depth in a way that is appealing to the highest level, high money type of star that wants to come back to Chicago. This might be the last chance they get, but I think the plan makes sense, maybe more sense now than it did a couple of weeks ago, and certainly more sense than it did like 5 months ago.
Yeah, but in that way, if this were the plan, then you don't pass up trading Andre Drummond for 2 second round picks. You don't pass up that first rounder that's offered for Caruso. You don't re-sign Lonzo Ball if someone is offering you something. And I've heard all the justifications for it, but it just seems like they've arrived at this position when there are so many other moves that already would have had our timetable moved up a little bit.
I agree. I do agree with that. I think you could have accelerated this process, but also I think people looked at the quality talent of the team that was there, the quality of the players that were there, and say what you will about Zach LaVine's tenure here, he was still a superstar level player or an all-star caliber player, a guy who scores at a rate that nobody really on this team has the ability to do right now on a consistent basis. You could say a similar thing about DeMar DeRozan. You could say a similar thing about the defensive impact of an Alex Caruso. And the frustrating thing about that is not getting the capital back, or really any capital back, from those three specific players, right? But when you have those three players on a roster, like, you're like, what are the Sacramento Kings thinking right now? That's a very similar looking roster to what the Bulls had a year ago or 2 years ago. You're not looking at Sacramento and thinking, well, shoot, in a competitive West, we should hit the reset button. That's not what teams think. I don't think that's what organizations want to have the mindset of, because that does bleed into the other efforts of your organization, whether that is getting free agents, that is getting high value pieces, that is trying to get capital back. Do I think they've messed up at times? Yeah, I think they've had a lot of misses in the last 2 years in terms of moves, draft picks, not making moves. Yeah, I think those are misses. If you're willing to hit the reset button at some point, you have to be willing to hit it now just as much as you were willing to hit it a year ago when your talent was better. So I get, again, every frustration that is within a fan, buddy, I'm there. Like, mm-hmm. I'm the one who's got to sit through this night in and night out. You guys get to turn it off and separate for a while and then come back to it when you guys feel like it or when they've earned your trust back. So I'm the one who's got to watch this and track this. But I also wanted to see them compete. I wanted to see Alex Caruso have a reason to play hard. I wanted to see Andre Drummond have a reason to play hard off the bench. I wanted to see those things. I'm sure that's what the front office, I'm sure that's what Donovan wanted to see. I'm sure that's what fans wanted to see. You don't want to see quality talent and not have them compete and play at a high quality level. The talent base that you see now, again, I feel bad saying this. I'm not trying to insult the talent level or quality or skill set of players, but if you compare them to other teams, this is not a team that has any player on this roster right now that somebody outside is going to say, I need him immediately to make my team a contender. That's what the Bulls are trying to improve upon. And now they've hit the reset button or some form of the button. Again, do you want to say it's a year late, 2 years too late? You can say that. And I'm not going to argue with you and tell you that you're wrong. I do understand why it wasn't hit better now than I did before. And I'm glad that at the very least, there is some form of an idea about how to make this better within the next 12 to 15 months, whatever timeline you want to put on it.
Adam, before we let you go, you're going to be calling the Bulls game tonight against the Knicks, but baseball season is here, baby. We got spring training kicking up. I just want to get your thoughts, because frustrations, talent level, all that stuff applies to both the Cubs and the White Sox. How good and how bad would those two teams be in your eyes as a national voice on the sport?
I still don't see the White Sox getting better than any of the other teams in the division.
Right.
Can you lose 120 games again? I don't think so. I think you just by sheer luck, you might be a little bit better than 120 losses. But I don't expect them to be outside of the fifth spot. I think the Tigers got a little better, even though they're not a great defensive team. Tigers are still solid. Guardians are good. Twins are talented enough. You know, KC put together a great run this year. On the National League side, like, I still think the Brewers are probably the best team in the division, but I think talent-wise, you've seen the level go up for the Cubs, and I feel much more comfortable with where the Cubs are now. I'm going to see the Cubs. We're calling one of their Tokyo games against the Dodgers in March.
Cool. Awesome.
I won't be one for it. Let's not get excited. All right, it's one of those things where you're in a box in Los Angeles, but nonetheless, we at least get to see them early. And I'll see a bunch of them in the regular season from Wrigley and all that. I do feel better about where the Cubs are at. I love the Tucker signing. I think Turner is a good piece. It's not Bregman, but it's a piece. It's a veteran piece that understands what October's about, and a guy you can plug in multiple spots on your infield and still has a very good demeanor, a very good clubhouse guy that I think will make a good impact. So I have high hopes for what the Cubs can do this year. I know we said that last year too. I expect a better start this year than we saw last year. And I think they should be competing for a playoff spot again.
Adam Amin, welcome back to Bulls Action. We'll be watching and listening here on the Score to the radio call as well, because our guys Chuck and Bill are back in action as well. So thanks for joining us. Have fun.
I appreciate you guys. Thank you so very much.
Thanks, Adam. Adam Amin.